This is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of November. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. The debate over Syrian refugees and whether Texas can block them from resettling here.
That individual, just like anybody else living in the United States, is able to freely move around the U.S.
Austin is becoming more friendly to cyclists, according to one national group, but there's still room for improvement.
Austin is certainly deserving of this designation, but Austinites still deserve better.
And most U.S. cereals and breads have folic acid to prevent birth defects, but you still can't find it in corn tortillas.
Nobody knows how it works. All we know is that it does work.
Those stories and more coming up in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, just a reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. You go there and you'll find links to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, RSS. Please leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts app if you haven't already. And if you have any questions, just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Or if you prefer email, you can email me, nathan@kut.org. A reminder, we won't have a KUT weekend next week for the Thanksgiving weekend. I hope you have a wonderful holiday. Now, Texas Governor Greg Abbott says more Syrian refugees will not be welcome in this state. This is after the attacks in Paris last week that killed at least 129 people. Suicide bomber who blew himself up in Paris last week was found with a Syrian passport. That passport was later determined to be fake, so it remains unclear if that bomber was Syrian, but he still may have used the same route, the same migration route as Syrian refugees, because he was fingerprinted on an island in Greece in October where Syrian refugees would arrive. At least five of the attackers were French nationals. Nevertheless, Abbott says there's no way to know if Syrian refugees are terrorists.
As governor of the state of Texas, I will not roll the dice and take the risk on allowing a few refugees in simply to expose Texans to that danger.
Abbott has ordered the state's refugee resettlement program not to help any Syrian refugees in Texas. That program, by the way, is funded by the federal government, and it helps people who have already been designated as refugees by the U.S. State Department. Abbott is also saying he wants to stop nonprofits that are using federal money to help resettle refugees in Texas. Can he actually do that? KUT's Ben Philpott reports.
There are two organizations in Austin designated by the U.S. State Department to resettle refugees, and both were scrambling Monday to find out what the governor's directive means.
A lot of people are asking me, what jurisdiction does Governor Abbott have? And honestly, I don't know that answer.
Amy Jackson is with Caritas, an Austin-based nonprofit that helps people in poverty. The group also helps refugees and their families get settled in Austin. That means everything from helping with job training to getting their kids enrolled in school. A similar group, Refugee Services of Texas, has already been helping at least 18 Syrians get on their feet in Texas. In a statement released Monday afternoon, the group asked Abbott to rescind his directive, but it's also asking lawyers what Governor Abbott's order means. Jackson, with Caritas, says she doesn't know exactly how the order affects them either, but she says what Caritas does is funded by federal dollars, not state.
The state of Texas obviously has some part of this process, but really this is more of a federal mandate than anything.
And when a refugee does come to the U.S., the federal government grants that refugee legal status in the U.S. Denise Gilman is with the Immigration Law Clinic at UT Austin.
That individual, just like anybody else living in the United States, is able to freely move around the U.S., move from state to state as that person chooses, and a state simply cannot shut off its borders to somebody living within the United States with lawful refugee status.
So maybe Abbott's directive stops a Syrian refugee from being initially located in Texas. But Gilman says there's no way the state could keep that person from then moving to Texas. And the confusion over Abbott's directive and those from a couple dozen governors goes all the way to the top. Mark Toner is deputy spokesperson for the U.S. State Department. The agency has a goal of bringing 10,000 Syrians to the U.S. next year.
You know, it's incumbent on us moving forward as we strive to reach this target of at least 10,000 for fiscal year 2016, to work with state and local governments to address their concerns about our resettlement program.
But when pressed by reporters to answer whether state governors have the power to block Syrian refugees,
as to your specific question, whether they can legally do that, I don't have an answer for you.
The State Department, just like all those local refugee agencies, is talking to its lawyers. Ben Philpott, KUT News.
Meanwhile, a prominent Democrat was in Texas this week, and she addressed Governor Abbott's declaration on Syrian refugees. Here's KUT's Jimmy Moss with that story.
Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton made a campaign stop in Dallas. She took swipes at her challengers on the Democratic side, but held her most withering criticisms for Republicans. She slammed Governor Greg Abbott for blocking Medicaid expansion and said he was wrong to keep Syrian refugees from entering the state. She does say asylum seekers should be screened to make sure they're not a threat to national security.
But we can't act as though we're shutting the doors to people in need without undermining who we are as Americans and the values we have stood for.
Governor Abbott has also announced the appointment of a Texas refugee coordinator and directed the state health department to send changes in refugee policies to federal officials. As for Clinton, she spent much of Tuesday fundraising. The former Secretary of State spoke for a half hour to students and supporters at Mountain View College, detailing plans to raise wages, grow jobs, and reform health insurance. She also played to the students in the room, saying she wants everyone to have the opportunities she has, and that starts with college.
I want to make college affordable again, and I want you to be able to refinance your debt and save thousands of dollars in order to be able to get on with your lives.
The rally was Clinton's third public appearance in Texas this year. She's been to the state several more times for private fundraisers. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
A member of the Austin City Council says he wants to prevent Syrian refugees from coming to Austin. That's putting him at odds with the mayor, though. The council member is Don Zimmerman. He's a conservative city council member. He's frequently finding himself at odds with his more liberal colleagues who outnumber him on the dais. But Zimmerman's proposing a resolution on Syrian refugees that would direct all city agencies not to take any action or spend any money that would help people fleeing conflict in Syria resettle in Austin.
It only takes a handful of people to cause a lot of murder and mayhem.
It's unclear exactly how many city resources are devoted to helping Syrian refugees. But we know Austin Travis County Health and Human Services provides health screenings to all refugees. That includes testing for tuberculosis and providing immunizations. Zimmerman says he is also looking at charities that may receive city grants.
If we gave money to an organization like Caritas or ECHO, you know, Homeless Coalition, do they look at passports? I don't know.
Austin Mayor Steve Adler points out that Syrian refugees undergo some of the strictest background checks of anyone entering the country.
It's okay for us to accept refugees because it's safe. The folks at the front of the line are women, their children, and the elderly. This is really about the most vulnerable.
Now, Zimmerman wants a public hearing on his proposal at a meeting of the Public Safety Committee on Monday, November 30th. There's going to be invited experts arguing for and against, and then public discussion. That's on the evening of Monday, November 30th. Now, this week, vandals splattered feces on the entrance of a mosque in Pflugerville, and they mixed it with pages torn out of the Quran. Faisal Maim is on the board of the Islamic Center of Pflugerville.
Somebody had splattered a lot of feces, taken pages of the Quran, probably not from inside the mosque, but from however they obtained it and torn it, and they had put those torn pages of the Quran in the filth.
He says he's still trying to figure out how to explain this to his kids.
Kids were born and bred here and don't know any other country except the United States. And, you know, they say the Pledge of Allegiance in their school. They do that. They're Americans. What do I tell them? You are Americans, but not quite.
Pflugerville police have opened an investigation into this. Now, a 7-year-old boy donated all of the money in his piggy bank to the mosque to help them clean up. He's not Muslim. His name is Jack Swenson, and he donated about $20 that he had originally gathered up in pennies. The Republican Agriculture Commissioner of Texas, Sid Miller, is drawing criticism from some people and praise from some others for a controversial Facebook post he made this week comparing refugees to rattlesnakes. Jim Malowitz is covering this story for our reporting partner, the Texas Tribune.
The post juxtaposes two pictures. One is this pile of rattlesnakes, and the other is this long line of refugees. And Miller says, "Can you tell me which of these rattlers won't bite you? Sure, some of them won't, but tell me which ones so we can bring them into the house." So basically, he's alluding to efforts to not allow any more Syrian refugees to settle in Texas. Right now, it's really just the Texas Democrats coming out and condemning it, you know, saying that he's comparing these refugees to animals. But the post itself has been liked over 4,100 times and shared 6,250 times. In talking to Miller's campaign spokesperson, you know, he doubled down by elevating it to the top of his page so it'd be easier for people to find.
That's Jim Malowitz with The Trip. People who were affected by flooding at the end of October, a lot of them are still cleaning up. And a lot of them are in southeastern Travis County. Some had flooding up to their necks. They talked about a wall of water, stuff they had never seen before. Travis County officials said Tuesday these stories demand an investigation into exactly what happened. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has more on that.
When Stacy Scheffel describes the flooding in southeast Travis County, it sounds like a horror film.
Things went on there that I can't explain, and I don't know that the answer is we just had a lot more rain than we actually planned for.
Residents described unprecedented flooding. Three people lost their lives in the disaster on October 30th. So Travis County has decided it'll go in and try to find out what happened. It'll be the first study of its kind by the county.
The city and the county are deeply engaged in trying to figure out what the heck happened there, because this was completely unexpected.
Judge Sarah Eckhart has also directed county officials to look into residents' claims about insurance. Many said Tuesday they were told they did not need flood insurance after being dropped from the FEMA floodplain map. Parts of Thoroughbred Farms, just west of Circuit of the Americas, have been in a floodplain map since 1982. But in 2008, some parts were taken off. County officials say new FEMA floodplain maps include more of the area. Those maps become official in January. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Austin's creeks and waterways are part of what has attracted people to this part of the world for thousands of years, but of course they also create flooding hazards. Now, when one heavy rain on top of another sends all this debris, tons of it, into the creeks, that flood risk becomes even more difficult to control. KUT's Mose Bouchel took a look at that.
So to see exactly how, I've come down here to the Bolden neighborhood. I think that's where we are, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm here with?
Roxanne Jackson with Watershed Protection Department.
Great, and we're here at a creek where a creek goes under a bridge. What are we looking at here?
We're looking at a nice babbling brook, but during rainfall events, the creek rises and water and debris and trash convey down this stream.
And convey means they just...
It moves on down the line.
And sometimes it gets jammed up, I guess.
And sometimes it does.
You think it would be okay if I just jump down there for
you
a second?
It's real soft and...
All right, let's see. Maybe we'll find some arrowheads or something. Yeah, I'm under the bridge now, and you can hear there's a storm drain that's bringing some water into the creek here, and then the rest of the water flowing through the creek under the bridge. There's some vegetation that's wrapped a little bit around the bridge. There's something stuck under there, right?
Yep. There is what it looks like a large tree and a root ball, and we have a work order in. So we have crews that will come back out here and pull all this material out.
Right, the bridge could almost become like a dam if enough.
It does, yes. If a large, say a large tree backs up and blocks that, and then other material keeps backing up behind it, then you have like a little dam. And then it rises up and will go over the road, and then the road has to be closed.
The reason I'm asking you about this now is because we have seen so much rain. What's it been like?
It's been a crazy year. So just from Halloween alone, we've already pulled out over 277 tons of debris from that one event.
So why not just take a bulldozer and just run through this whole thing and just let all the water just shoot down the creek, and then maybe you wouldn't have as much debris to worry about?
No, I don't think that we want to just have, you know, Los Angeles concrete channels running through our city. We wouldn't have the habitat that we have. We would probably create erosion problems. So there's a lot of things. You can't just address one issue and not think about the whole picture.
All right, thank you. Reporting from a creek in South Austin, I'm Mose Bouchel, KUT News. Well, look it. And I might have even just found a little fossil here.
Yeah, no, that's definitely something.
Little shell.
When we hear local political leaders and bureaucrats talk about fixing traffic congestion in Austin, one of the things they like to talk about a lot is alternate modes of transportation. And that's partly why the city has been trying to make Austin more cycling friendly. It's made some progress in that regard. And this week, Austin earned a gold level designation from the League of American Bicyclists. So to understand what that means, I talked to Ian Dilley. He's a reporter for Bicycling Magazine. His newest book is The Cyclist's Bucket List, and he lives in Austin.
It's actually a really big deal. You know, the League of American Bicyclists has been around since the late 1800s, and every year they consider, you know, a number of cities that have applied for this designation through the league, and they either keep them at the same level, which is, you know, bronze, silver, and gold and platinum level status, or they give them an upgrade. And the city of Austin has been at the silver level for a number of years now and was just recently upgraded to the gold level, which there's only a handful of cities, maybe two dozen cities across the U.S. that are rated at the gold level. So it's a huge step forward for the city of Austin and really just a acknowledgement that the city is moving in the right direction.
What is the city doing to be moving in the right direction right now?
Yeah, so two things on that. The city of Austin certainly is deserving of this designation. I think anybody who rides a bike around Austin or drives a vehicle or gets around Austin anyway, you know, the changes are just visible sort of at every turn, from bike lanes on major arterial roads and bridges, such as, you know, the South First Street Bridge, and some sort of areas where they can currently squeeze them in, like on Lamar, and hopefully expand them in the future. And then also, you know, it's really what Austin has done that's been impressive is these major projects like the boardwalk, which, you know, creates just this beautiful link from Austin's east side to its west side. The bridge across the Greenbelt that will run underneath MoPac is a huge step forward as well. You know, that's something that's been a huge barrier for people traveling around that side of Austin by bicycle. And then trails like the South Walnut Creek Trail are just these world-class trail systems really that have been implemented by the city. And then also sort of just things that, you know, cyclists of all ages and abilities can use. You know, you're seeing a lot of protected bike lanes around elementaries, which allows kids to more safely ride their bikes to school.
But yet the percentage of people who cycle in Austin is still relatively low compared to, you know, Portland, Boulder, Seattle, Minneapolis, and way lower compared to major European cities, of course.
Yeah, so I guess that was the second part of my statement as to whether Austin is deserving, is that, you know, the first is that Austin is certainly deserving of this designation. The second part is that Austinites certainly still deserve better. There's still a lot of major issues in Austin. Cycling is pretty great if you live around campus or in central Austin, but further out, more suburban parts of Austin, like Northwest Austin and suburban South Austin, you're still seeing really low ridership, and that adds to Austin having an overall pretty low ridership in comparison to other cities that have this designation. I think in the last census, less than 2% of Austinites commuted to work by bike, which is not making a huge dent on the overall transportation network.
What is it going to take to get more people cycling in Austin? I feel like it's got to be more than a white line on the road marking off a bike lane, because I think a lot of people don't feel safe in that situation.
You know, it's a term that's referred to as comfort level. So when you make cycling easy and accessible and safe, more and more people ride. And that's what Austin is working towards with some of these more modern cycling facilities, like protected bike lanes that allow cyclists to get out on the road and not feel like they're competing with cars for space on the road. The other thing is you just need to make cycling more attractive than other means of transportation. Most major cities that have seen a huge increase in cycling, it's because those cities have made cycling the fastest way to get around.
Ian Dilley is a reporter for Bicycling Magazine. His newest book is The Cyclist's Bucket List, and he lives in Austin. Ian, thanks for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for giving me a call.
A new Texas law allows high school students to graduate even if they have not passed all the required standardized tests. KUT's Kate McGee tells us some in the business community are concerned that school districts are using the law to graduate students who might not be ready.
The new law allows schools to create something called a graduation committee. The group is made up of school administrators, teachers, parents, and counselors. It decides if a student who's passed all of their classes can graduate high school, even if they haven't passed two of the five required end-of-course exams. State Senator Kel Seliger wrote the bill.
What Senate Bill 149 was intended to do was to ensure that young people were not artificially kept from graduating by the STAR test.
So if a student has trouble taking tests but knows the content, they'd still be able to graduate. The bill passed with overwhelming support in the House and Senate and provided hope for about 28,000 seniors who are at risk of not graduating this year.
I think it's important to look at as much information as possible.
After the bill passed, the Texas Association of Business sent an open records request to the 100 school districts with the largest student population. They wanted to see how many students were allowed to graduate under this new policy. 78 districts responded. In those districts, 71% of students who asked for a waiver received one and graduated. Bill Hammond is the CEO of the TAB.
That's a shockingly high number. Effectively, that the high school diploma for those kids means little or nothing, and they will not be ready to succeed in life.
Some districts, like Dallas ISD, only approved about a fifth of the students who requested a waiver. Most school districts approved more than two-thirds of the requests, but some approved 100%. Multiple Central Texas districts did not return requests for comment, including Austin ISD, where 81% of students who asked for the waiver received it, 91 students total. Education policy expert Sandy Kress says all the numbers raise questions.
It's not the occasional student who has a testing problem. Districts are waving everybody through.
The graduation committees are another example of the state moving away from tough accountability standards put in place years ago. Before this, the state legislature reduced the number of end-of-course exams from 15 to 5. Even schools have been getting a break. Since the STAR test was introduced, the state has been picking and choosing which tests count towards school performance rankings.
The education community, tragically, in my opinion, have revolted against being held accountable for their performance.
That's Bill Hammond again, but Senator Seliger rejects that point of view.
Is the STAR test the definitive measure of secondary accomplishment? I don't think it is.
The law is only in effect through the 2016-17 school year. Lawmakers will have to revisit the law next session. Kate McGee, KUT News.
There is a simple way to protect unborn children against severe spinal cord or brain birth defects. Eat a bowl of cereal. If the cereal was processed in the U.S., it's been fortified with folic acid. And getting about 400 micrograms of that every day can prevent those birth defects. Most U.S. cereals have 100% of the daily value, but products made from corn masa flour, those are not fortified because the Food and Drug Administration does not allow it. KUT's Veronica Saragovia explains why the flour has been left out and why some groups are trying to change that.
Dr. R.J. Berry says you can't understate the importance of folic acid.
The story of folic acid is one of the great public health stories of ever.
Berry works with the Division of Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta.
The truth is that nobody knows how it works. All we know is that it does work. We know from the highest quality scientific studies, randomized trials, that folic acid will prevent neural tube defects.
The neural tube is the embryonic part that forms into the brain and spinal cord. So a problem at that developmental stage can obviously have serious defects like anencephaly. That means the embryo doesn't form a brain, or the spine defect, spina bifida.
Before you know it, she has a heart. Before you know you.
Here's one of the CDC's public service announcements on folic acid from 1999.
That's when you need to take folic acid every day. After that, it's too late to prevent some serious birth defects. Folic acid now, before you know it.
Health officials say before you know is the key. Half of all pregnancies are unplanned. Dean Appling is a biochemistry professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
The requirement for folic acid is so early in the pregnancy that most women, by the time they know they're pregnant, they've already passed that critical window. And if they had a problem with folic acid, it would be too late at that point to prevent the birth defect.
Which is why the FDA started adding folic acid to enriched bread, flour, cornmeal, rice, pasta, and other grain products in 1998, but not corn masa. That brings us to the El Milagro plant in San Marcos. Here, tortilla products are made from raw corn. Listen closely and you'll hear corn kernels churning out of this machine into a container. This corn gets softened using a process dating back thousands of years. General Manager Hector Ramirez explains how it's done today.
Lime, essentially, when you add it to water and boil the water with corn above 150 degrees, the corn goes through a process called nixtamalization.
Nixtamalization hails from ancient Mesoamerica, what's now Mexico and Central America. The lime used at El Milagro comes from limestone. It makes grinding the corn into masa much easier because it softens the kernel. But the process doesn't involve adding folic acid. Cynthia Pellegrini is with the March of Dimes. She says the benefits of fortifying foods have not been seen among Latinos.
It was thought that part of the reason for that was that these groups just weren't consuming the same level of wheat flour products. Instead, they were consuming corn masa flour products because that was the staple grain in that diet.
So the March of Dimes and other groups in a coalition want the FDA to set a standard for how much folic acid a manufacturer could add to corn masa. The FDA has responded by asking the petitioning groups to study whether adding folic acid would affect the shelf life of a corn tortilla. Last month, the FDA received the stability study from the petitioners. They expect to hear from the FDA again in mid-January. Veronica Saragovia, KUT News.
Travis County Commissioners this week okayed the sale of 7.5 acres of county-owned property in East Austin. The buyer is Dick Rothgaber. He will donate the land to the local Salvation Army for a new women and children's shelter. And that land is adjacent to the current Austin Shelter for Women and Children, also operated by the Salvation Army and funded by the City of Austin. So, okay, in fiscal year 2014, that shelter served 120 women and 249 children, and those were women and children in crisis who needed a place to stay and they needed services to get back on their feet. One of the women that shelter has helped is Kimberly. She asked us not to use her last name because her children attend local schools. But Kimberly was working, had a house and two kids, and then things started to unravel.
I went through some medical stuff, like arthritis and stuff like that. So then I bounced back from that. And then I got pregnant and had a baby, and the arthritis kind of kicked back in. So I was on like a medical leave again. So I went from two jobs to one and not having all the extra hours that I could to supplement the income. It got to a point where we were kind of like stretching and pinching and borrowing. The stress of the borrowing and the paying back and the mental part of it is just like exhausting. And so I had put my name on the list. Then I got a call from the shelter that our room was ready. I was actually out of town and I was like, we're on our way back. The shelter, living there was for me, like I told my kids, but I had no problem with the structure. Being a single parent, I think that the structure was great for us. And as long as you followed, you know, the procedures and the rules, we had no problems. You know, my kids are pretty active, one basketball, and we're working towards 4 a.m. basketball scholarship. She was going into her junior year. Yeah, when we went there, So it was kind of rocky at first, you know, for my kids, you know. We utilized the counseling services there to kind of help them transition. And because we were in transitional living, they were still able to go to their same schools. Through another program called Project Hope, they come to the shelter, pick up the kids and take them to, you can take them to and from their schools. I didn't want them to feel the turbulence, like as I say, that I was going through. I wanted to keep it as close as normal for them as possible. And they kind of went through some things, but the counseling really worked for me. And one of my kids really benefited from the counseling. While we were there, I always told them to get the big picture. So you see how we are, you see we're here. I said, so when you, I always tell them, when you have your own room, you should be, you'll be real more appreciative of your having your own space and, you know, things like that. And I've paid off like three of my debts since then, and more since being in the, from the time of the shelter and to now, since being on my own, I paid off a lot of debt, both on my own and with the help of and the programs that I was referred to from the shelter. Those programs helped me pay that debt and be able to get into our own place. As you know, I'm in culinary school, so I was recruited at my school by one of the chefs there. And so I'm working in the field as well as going to my school. My desire as after finished school, as far as the culinary field is concerned, is I want to be initially a private chef, personal chef. Ultimately, I would like to have my own cafe or something like that, and then also be able to service the homeless population with some hot meals when I'm able to. My primary way of giving back is completing my goals and doing what I'm set out to do and being responsible. So I share with women, and I have a group called Mirror Mirror, and I kind of share with women about the program, about the shelter and things like that. So I remember at Christmas when somebody walked around and put stockings in all of our rooms, with those things that will just like, kind of like, not necessarily nest, like you needed them, but they was great, like some body lotion that smelled pretty good and some different stuff like that. So I wanted to build zip bags filled with things that I felt like women, like they might appreciate being in the shelter with or without kids. So I have some women working with me to collect some of those items that I requested, like a wish list. Peaceful. It's an inner peace. I can't put it into words, and I'm grateful.
You can find out more about the Salvation Army at salvationarmy.org. That's KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of November. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget, subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. If you have any questions or comments, shoot me an email, nathan@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then,